Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women. Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous. Alisa Seagrave, author and journalist. First of all, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you.
So you're here to talk about a book about your mother, the girl from Station X, My Mother's Unknown Life. As we know, mothers are so important to us. They are our role model for life. Tell us about your mother.
Well, when I was a very young child, I absolutely adored my mother and I wanted to be very close to her all the time. I wanted more physical affection from her. I think she was quite withdrawn in that way, but I absolutely adored her. I remember the way she smiled. I was the first child. I did spend time with her. But then later in life, everything became very difficult. I think it was triggered off by my brother being drowned, age five, in my grandmother's swimming pool. It was on my seventh birthday. My poor mother was packing up our rented house with my father, and this tragedy occurred, and I think my mother actually never totally recovered. I think her friend said she'd had a nervous breakdown after it. She became very withdrawn. My youngest brother was a baby. There was another one of just three, and I think I certainly felt abandoned by my mother, and what was worse was I felt that she preferred the dead child. I think this is very common. Women apparently often idolise a child that's died. So I felt that he was better than me. I could never live up to my dead brother. My mother had retreated into this sort of favouritism and grief.
Yeah, you said that she had like trinkets and things around, you know, the house all the time. It's quite morbid in a way.
In her bedroom was a shrine to him. All her life in that bedroom, ever since she moved house, and then she had to move when she got Alzheimer's, and even then the pictures of him, the big pictures, were taken to her new bedroom. There was one very large oval picture of him holding a ball in a page's outfit. He'd once been a page, looking very happy, and below that she'd put his favourite little fluffy animals on a shelf, and then on another shelf in her bedroom were his toy taxis. He had dinky cars, like a lot of boys in the 50s. It was a sort of shrine to him.
Gosh, it's incredible. So I suppose in those days there was no therapy. So how did your mother cope? Or she didn't cope, really, did she?
No, it's very difficult for me to know that now. Her old nanny lived with us. I think that her old nanny, she was an only child. Her brother had died. He was born disabled, died when my mother was five, and her father had died when she was 1 year old. She didn't like her stepfather, who'd my grandmother had remarried soon after the little boy died, I think. So my mother was an only child, and she had this nanny who actually we all loved too. She was a lovely woman, but I think possibly she did spoil my mother. Anyway, the nanny lived with us, and she would, I think my mother took a great deal of comfort from her presence. I suppose possibly she found the nanny much more soothing than my father, and that also must have caused jealousy in him. But I think she dealt with the death, but I suppose she talked to certain women friends. I remember she made two friends. One was a lady in the village who'd had a little girl who died, and then she made friends with some other woman who I think had only had one child who died falling out of a train aged 11. And she bonded very much with these women. I think that helped her to talk about the dead children. But then, of course, I overheard a bit of the conversation. To me, that made it worse, because I overheard someone saying about my brother, he wasn't like the others.
So everything was reinforcing that you were kind of not worth it.
Yes, but now looking back, I can see my parents tried. I mean, they took me on holiday alone, as I was 4 years older than the next brother. They took me on holiday to Spain, I suppose to make up for this, to try to help me. I had picked up all the other stuff going on in my mother's subconscious and everything. So in a way, it didn't make up for it.
Yeah, and your mother was not available for you emotionally, was
she? That's correct. Unfortunately, that's correct, yes. Oddly enough, the woman whose son had died falling out of a train had had a puppy. He was about 8 months, and she gave it to me. And so my dog was a companion. And then later, it was had a very odd breed. I'd never heard of it before or since. It was called a Braunston Terrier, and it was like a black and brown Jack Russell. My brother, of course, got older and I became closer to him, the one who was 4 years younger, but the dog was tremendously important for me.
So it was actually a harrowing relationship you had with your mother in the end, wasn't it? Because she became an alcoholic.
Yes, I think she always had the tendency, because later I saw in the war diaries she started drinking quite heavily in the war, more than her contemporaries. It was sort of binge drinking every so often. She had the tendency, but obviously, I mean, it became worse because she was drowning her sorrows. My father also drank, but he had a much steadier head. My mother was very quickly became drunk and maudlin and sentimental. It was rather frightening, in fact.
I remember you saying that it's like she'd come and sit on your bed and there were ramblings.
Yes, she would sort of... She was trying to be emotionally close to me, I'm afraid. That's the awful thing. She was trying to be affectionate, but because she came across as so unstable... It was rather frightening.
So you sort of recoiled from her
yes.
advances?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, yes, yeah. yes.
And I remember you saying it, you could just smell her breath.
Yeah. Yes, cigarettes and drink, yes. Mm.
So she demanded everything from you in later life, though, when you got grown up, didn't you? Because she did slip into alcoholism and she just started being quite abusive to you, demanding and always in a kind of grump, really.
Well, unfortunately, she had two other tragedies as well as everything else. My brother that was 4 years younger died of 24. He also was an alcoholic.
What did he die
of? Overdose of Valium. Oh. We don't know whether it was intentional. And my father died at only 64. And although my mother wasn't really in love with him, in a way, a woman is in love with a man. She was very, very dependent on him. She was much more fond of him than she'd realised. I think she was grief-stricken. And also, he'd done a great deal for her, practically. And so then I had to rather fulfil, to some extent, his role. I was the oldest child left. And yes, my mother became very needy and she kept falling over drunk, breaking her limbs, that sort of thing.
So you just became more and more resentful, didn't you?
Yes, yes, yeah. I did. Yes, because I felt she was taking over my life. Even when I had children, there would be these accidents. My ex-husband and I would be called to rescue. We didn't know what to do. This went on.
So it's like having a kind of annoying teenager sort of thing in your life.
It was exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what my mother's persona was like.
My weekday fix? Darling, it has to be Radio Gorgeous.
The thing is, it sounds like I'm, of course, giving the bad side of her as the daughter, but actually my mother was incredibly entertaining and good company. She had a lot of very good women friends. And one of the reasons, I think, was she was like a teenager. She had the sort of vitality of a teenager, but also the unpredictability.
Mm. She could kind of, she could tell amusing stories, she could entertain. I mean, I can imagine, you said, she's in hospital, you'd already arrived, she made friends of everybody there. I mean, she's obviously a very gregarious character.
She had absolute charm and it's an odd paradox of her, in one way being very self-centred, she was also a very good listener. She was very interested in people. She was completely unsnobbish from very early on. She had been brought up in a privileged way, but from very early on, the enormous numbers of people from all different classes and nationalities came to our house. So she had this very, very good side. That's, I think yeah. She would have been happy if she'd been able to lead a more bohemian life.
Yes, it sounds like it. So a decade ago, you're clearing out your mother's house. She'd been moved into a smaller place due to her Alzheimer's and you found her diaries. Part one of a book starts off with a statement from your mother called Anne, and I was just wondering whether you'd like to read it out.
Yes, she wrote this when she was 16 in her diary. I am very reserved and never show my feelings, so that very few people know what I am like inside. I long for romance. I would like to be truly in love with a man and one in love with me. The real true love, nothing else would do. I'm afraid I will never have the chance of marrying anyone, as I don't like men.
That's really shocking, isn't it?
I wonder, you know, at first I read it, of course, with hindsight, but my mother really did prefer women. I think she probably was gay. But when I read it, I thought, well, she's written it as a teenager and perhaps she doesn't like men then because she doesn't really get on with her stepfather and she wasn't brought up with brothers. But at the same time, I also saw it as a sort of statement of her real nature.
So it was very exciting because you found the diaries. She was still alive, but she had Alzheimer's, so she kind of wasn't that aware. You found your mother.
That's exactly what happened. I remember the first time I saw the diaries, I was incredibly excited. I realised at once what this could mean. I realised it was a lifeline. She'd kind of thrown me a lifeline, perhaps unintentionally, I don't know. I mean, she was a hoarder. I don't know why she kept the diaries. Did she actually want me to read them? I hope she did.
So when you started reading them, you found out that she, you found out her feelings, you found out her thoughts, things that you'd never, ever, ever got to when, you know, growing up.
That's right. And I slowly became much more sympathetic to her. There was flashes, you know, about her early childhood. I felt very sorry for her about her little brother and her father dying. And then she was a bridesmaid at her mother's wedding to her stepfather. She was carrying an enormous bunch of flowers. I felt that, you know, that this lonely little girl had already had these two shocks and now her mother was marrying a relative stranger. All this kind of made me see her in a different light. And I also, because she wrote the diaries with such fervour, I saw that she was a tortured person. She was tortured and I felt sorry for all the dilemmas that she expressed in the diaries.
No, it's really, really interesting. It's very interesting because you had the childhood tragedy of your brother drowning and she'd had tragedy in her childhood. Now, isn't there a rumour in your family about the curse of being of drowning?
Well, yes, I drove past this house, Battle Abbey, actually on Saturday. My great-grandfather and his brother, they'd come from Ireland, they went to South America. They made money in the guano trade and shipping. And my great-grandfather, Michael Grace, then came to England to run the English branch of this company whose headquarters then, after South America, it was set up in New York. Anyway, I think he must have been very socially ambitious because he immediately rented this enormous house, Battle Abbey, in Battle, Sussex, you know, very near the Battle of Hastings. And he also took on the rent, 100-year lease, on a house in Belgrave Square, where my mother was born, 40 Belgrave Square. Those houses were owned by aristocrats.
So he was living at large, wasn't he?
He worked extremely hard right till old age. My grandmother, his daughter, always told me this. She said he worked harder than the young men who were courting her. He was always in the office.
So tell us about the curse then.
Well, the curse was Battle Abbey in the Reformation. It was given by Henry VIII to a man called Sir Anthony Browne, who I think was a Norman. Anyway, I read it all up in a book about Battle Abbey. Anthony Browne razed the church, the little church at Battle Abbey, to the ground and gave a banquet to celebrate that the monks were thrown out. Oh. It was a monastery. Anyway, at this celebratory banquet, a monk appeared with this terrible curse. He said, I think it was ye who've taken God's holy lands, your descendants will die by fire or water. Anyway, I mean, whether one believes in a curse or not, I have to say, I think it took quite a long time to be enacted. The first curse, several of the Browns' descendants, they were then called Montague, were drowned in some of them in the Rhine, others at Bognor Regis. Then the family that bought Battle Abbey, one of the women of the family and a governess were drowned in the lake. My grandmother, Elisa, was drowned in her 20s in Italy. Her husband and child were saved. Well, my brother was drowned. One of my grandmother's little nieces was also drowned in a swimming pool in America. She was a descendant, of course. My grandmother and her sisters had lived at Battle Abbey. I don't know. Anyway, but of course, we are rather frightened of a family curse. I don't know whether they'd take it seriously or not.
But what's interesting is that your mother had this sadness in childhood, which you had. You both had this sadness. So actually, through reading She's a Tortured Soul, you could relate to her.
Well, that's true, because she was so reticent about the little brother. She never mentioned him to me. She only mentioned him to my daughter. I think my daughter was about 7. They got on rather well. She showed my daughter photographs of her little brother. So it was obviously a very private thing for her.
What do you think he had now, looking back, being disabled?
He never sat up. I remember the old nanny said he never sat up. Mm. And he, I think he may have had something like cerebral palsy because his face is in a sort of grimace. And I found letters from my poor grandmother had taken him to a brain specialist and this kind of thing. And, of course, her husband had just died. He had died literally a few days before she gave birth. But her sister, Lisa, the one who was drowned, Elisa, had to give her the news. They waited till the child was born to give her this dreadful news.
So her husband had just died in the First World War?
Yes, he was on a job in France in the First World War. He was actually in a stupid car accident. He was going to do some intelligence thing. He was a soldier. And the man driving went into the shaft of a farm cart. It was sticking out. They drove into it. And my grandfather was the passenger. He died a few hours later.
Oh, yeah, didn't one of the stokes from the cart?
Yes, it pierced his ribs.
Listen to us online, on your phone, download a podcast, or on your tablet. Radio Gorgeous, there for you. Over 1,000 followers can't be wrong. Follow us on @radio_gorgeous on Twitter, darling, of course. Mwah.
Can you tell us some interesting things you found out about her life that you discovered when you read the diaries? She was an heiress. She was in the 30s. She was living this fabulous life. She was like a, you know, playboy. She was like a playgirl, you know, just playing tennis, golf, travelling, you know, going abroad, which no one else did, you know. She seemed to have a lovely life. Then the war happened, and actually she seems to have kind of risen in the war and really kind of got to grips with who she was.
Well, this is why I then came to admire my mother. I felt sympathetic, you know, before for the bits I told you about. But when I saw that immediately she had already enlisted in March 39 before war was declared, she'd got a letter from someone she'd been at her school, and she listed in the WAF. Anyway, so literally the day after the war was declared, my mother was in this very menial job at Kidbrook, Dulwich. She was listing uniforms, and she's found the whole thing very interesting. She particularly liked the character she met. Again, this shows a very good side of my mother. She was a never, never superior. She actually had rather an inferiority complex. She immediately sort of admired the people she met. You know, there were two 16-year-old boys who were, one of them is a Londoner, and she admired their cheerfulness and they had very hard lives and so on. Anyway, she then went to be a driver based in Cleveland Street off the Tottenham Court Road. She was chauffeuring WAF officers and the RAF officers in and out to balloon barrage sites outside London. So, ironically, her family had had a chauffeur in London and one in the country. And my mother, I suppose, because of her privilege, she knew how to drive a car. She probably knew how to maintain a car. And so she was doing all this stuff, you know, changing the wheels, maintaining the car, etc. So she very much threw herself in. And she I think she welcomed the chance to meet all these different people.
Then she ended up at Bletchley Park, the famous decoding place. How did that happen?
Well,
what did she do there?
I've never quite understood why she got the interview, because a woman appeared in the diary called Kate, who's never before or since appeared in the diary. It said Kate is at a place called a war station. She seemed to have arranged this interview. My mother was already had done a code and cipher course. And she was at this place nearby, Leighton Buzzard, which was doing a similar sort of thing. And anyway, so she went for three interviews for Bletchley. One of them was at Bletchley. One was in London. I think two were in London. And I think it was about 4 months later, she started at Bletchley, August 1941, literally a few days before, luckily for her, Churchill visited Bletchley.
Wow.
He only visited her hut and one other. It's incredibly exciting. So she started anyway as an indexer. When 1942, May 42, her hut became a naval hut. Hut 3 was split up into different sections. She then, although she was a WAF, she worked with the Navy. They'd come in there. Out of all the women in the hut, she was chosen at a rather important period, the lead up to Operation Torch, the Allied invasion of North Africa. Finally took place early November 42. She was chosen as what was called the fourth naval duty officer, sort of looking at very important data, deciding what was important and so on, often overnight duty. And this was tremendous plaudit for my mother, because she was chosen out of the other women. She had not had a formal education.
Not at all, no.
There were other people, of course, who'd been at university. And she showed that she had the skill to do this. And she, even at the time, she seemed to realise, she wrote, "I will never have such an important job again," which I think was right. And she was praised several times by her bosses. That was very exciting when I read about all that, because it showed my mother.
Has she ever told you that?
No.
Never, ever?
No. She'd not told me. I knew vaguely. I think another reason was that I knew she'd worked at Bletchley, but I think it was so ingrained in that generation. And indeed, I've met a woman locally recently who's got Alzheimer's, and the secrecy is so ingrained that this lady even now won't talk about what they were doing. And I think that's part of it.
Yes. So let's just talk a little bit about her being, you say she was probably a lesbian. She had crushes on women from about age 15, 16?
Yes, yes.
And you said, which was very intuitive, you said that you thought they all looked a bit like your grandmother. They were petite, with sort of mousy-ish hair, very, very pretty, delicate. And you said it's maybe because she wanted the affection of her mother, and it's a sort of a way of trying to find it.
The first women in that period in her teens and a little bit later, I realised they did all rather resemble my grandmother. I think it was because my grandmother, rather like my mother, I've just realised, and me, was grief-stricken by the death of her husband and son, and she went to sort of get away from it, to work in the Mesopotamia Comforts Fund. I think it was this was taking place in Italy. So basically, she left her little girl in the care of, again, my grandma had these wonderful older sisters. They were all much older than her. They absolutely adored my grandmother. And she left my mother in the care of one of them, Lynn, who was living in Sussex. And my mother was with the nanny, luckily for her. But nevertheless, her mother had left her. So I did wonder if that was something to do with these crushes on a certain physical sort of woman.
Nothing ever happened between the women. But when did she kind of swing back the other way? In other words, when did she start fancying men? Or do you think she never did?
Well, she had a big... It wasn't consummated, but she had a big fling in 1940 with a very handsome South African pilot. I've got his photograph. And I think she was very attracted to him. But, you know, with the intensity of wartime and everything, he was sort of stationed, went off somewhere else. He wanted to marry her. She was actually engaged to a naval officer, but he was away most of the time. And I don't think she was in love with him. We have to realise it was a tumultuous kind of time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think she was attracted to the pilot. Mm. And then later, at the very end of the war, she lost her virginity very late in life. She, I think, was in love for a while with this much older man, an American, who had a wife and children in, wow, back in Philadelphia. I suppose now I realise probably a sort of father figure. Anyway, he absolutely adored my mother. I've got 100 love letters. Mm. And he was a serious man. And he also realised that she should be using her intellect. Some of the letters are begging her to come back and work in post-war Germany because she'd been demobbed. She was there on their days off. They often met in the period April 45 to November 45. So he respected my mother. He respected her. She wasn't just a pretty woman. Mm.
So she was actually quite modern, really.
Yes, yes. I think she was in love with for a while with this man, but then she then got another crush as soon as the poor man was writing letters for her for on and on for well over 2 years, and she then got a crush on a Russian woman.
But you don't think it was ever consummated?
That wasn't. I think finally that she consummated her love for women after my father died with one woman.
Oh, wow. What, looking back, do you mean?
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty certain, yes, from what a couple of people said, and I think pretty certain, yes.
Wow.
That was several years after my father died.
Well, I'm pleased. Now, how did she meet your father?
I know that. No, I don't know other things about the courtship. Because she stopped writing diaries after the war, except when she was abroad. So there's nothing about the courtship. There were other men who were also trying to marry her. She was introduced by my Catholic cousin. And my grandmother had begged her cousin and a great friend of hers, Alice, because she was hoping that my mother wasn't going to go on with this liaison with the married American. Can you introduce Anne to somebody? And they had this little dinner, and my father was produced, so very Catholic. They also would have liked that about him. Anyway, my father immediately fell in love with my mother and took her out to a nightclub the same evening. And that's how they met.
And you say that they did have a good relationship then?
Oh, they did at first, in my babyhood, because he was in the Navy all his life. He had one diplomatic job, naval attaché in Madrid, and they had an absolutely wonderful time.
Give us pictures of you in Spain.
This is a idyllic period I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, when my mother adored me and they were very happy. My mother loved Spain. She was fascinated by it. She made enormous friends with other expats, with enormous number of Spaniards. She travelled in Spain.
God, it must have been interesting then.
Wow. Yes. So they got on very well then, and my father was right in the saddle. She was very interested in his job. And unfortunately, he was retired rather early from the Navy, because I think they had too many of them around. And that was not good for the marriage.
The rot set in there.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
It's been so fascinating talking to you today. How excited are you about the book going to paperback now?
I'm very excited, and I like the new informal cover. I mean, I like the hardback, but this is a sort of different look of the book. And it shows the sort of rather some of these liberated women on their bicycles in the WAF. It's a good look for my mother to have, and she would have very much liked that.
Great. And just lastly, what thing did you get mostly from reading the diaries? Yourself.
I actually discovered my real mother, and I became very sympathetic to her, and I ended up respecting her for her war work.
And loving her, maybe?
Yes, I think the diaries of the early Spain reconciled me to my mother. Yes, I suppose I do love my mother, yes.
That's so wonderful to have you on today. So The Girl of Station X by Lisa Seagrove is published by Oran Press. Now in paperback. Thank you so much, Elisa Seagrave, for coming onto Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you very much.
Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com. my weekday fix? Darling, it has to be Radio Gorgeous.